Thank you for your birthday greetings. Very helpful. I'm 40 years old today. Now, it's interesting. I make a very simple statement, and there's massive levels of disbelief in the congregation. But let me try and convince you otherwise. At least three people this week have said how young I look. And age is only a number. 60 is the new 40. The reality is that what matters is not the number of years, but actually how healthy you are. Some 40-year-olds look 60. Some 60-year-olds look 40. Some 40-year-olds are so unwell, they might as well be 60. Some 60-year-olds are so healthy, they might as well be 40. And if you take my age in the grand sweep of human history and judge my age not by how many years on earth I might have been, but how many years I have left, given that many people died in their 30s and 40s historically, and you judge my age reading backwards, in other words, how long I might have left to live in terms of average age, I am in fact 40. And so the truth is, it's much more honest to say I'm 40 years of age. Now, it's interesting that, because we have been told over the last few weeks a bunch of lies and dishonesty by both sides of a referendum campaign, and I know a lot of politicians, many of them are not dishonest people, but many of them have managed to convince themselves about something being true by a sophisticated set of arguments and a series on both sides of this debate, and a series verbal gymnastics to end up with something that sounds incredibly plausible. And I want to tell you something about both sides of this. Many of those politicians have convinced themselves that what they say is true, even though the reality is, just from a point of view of objective reality, from the outside, it just looks blatantly untrue. And the challenge for us, and by the way, I'm not 40, just because I want to tell the truth from the pulpit.
How old are you, darling?
41. So I don't want to tell the truth from the pulpit. What I do want to say is, we live in a time in our country where truth is on the scaffold. In other words, where truth is up for grabs. And the one of the roles the church has to play in all of this is to remind ourselves that truth is not eternally elastic or very flexible. That actually truth is truth is truth. And one of the reasons we have the Bible and why we're studying the Bible on a Sunday morning, why are we studying the Bible this morning? Why aren't we studying some other book? Is because fundamentally, as Christians, we believe that despite the passage of 2,000 years and the change of culture from the Middle East to the West and so on and so on, that the principles in this book remain true, eternally true, non-negotiably true. They're not elastic, though people try to make them so. They are the truth on which we base our lives. And so what we're reading in 1 Timothy, hard though it is true. Now, we have to struggle to interpret it, obviously, but we're foundationing on something that's solid and dependable. So please turn in your Bibles to 1 Peter 3. I better take my jacket off as it's getting warm in here. And I'm not just taking my jacket off because I'm afraid of the material in the next few minutes, although there is an element of that. And so here we are. Oh, my goodness. I am getting older, but I need my glasses to do that. Is it possible to have it in slightly larger typeface, a little bit at a time? Because that would be really, really helpful if we could do that. What's going to happen in a minute, hopefully, God willing, is that the screen will have sections of 1 Peter. We'll talk about it so that we understand this really important section. And then we'll turn away from the screen, if we want to, and just look at some key points from it. The first section is actually a continuance of... is that better?
Yes.
No, it's fine for me. I'm just... Is it fine for the congregation? Okay. The first section is a continuance of chapter 2. So when it says wives, comma, in the same way as what? I mean, it makes no sense, that opening sentence. One of the reasons why it makes no sense is that the chapter headings and the verse divisions in the New Testament are not inspired. They were put there artificially, and sometimes they're just to break the thing up into reasonable-sized chunks. Actually, if you just read the letter of Peter properly, you wouldn't have any of those chapter headings, and you would understand a bit more easily. So you have to go back to chapter 2 to understand in the same way as what are these wives supposed to behave. And the answer is in verse at the top of verse 11 in chapter 2, which is headed, interestingly enough, in my New International Version of the Bible, living godly lives in a pagan society. So the thing to remember, what Peter's addressing is in this whole holiness theme, is not you guys should be really holy, because when you get to heaven, some of you will be a 7 out of 10 in terms of holiness, some of you will be an 8 out of 10 in terms of holiness, the 8s out of 10 will get a better mansion, the 7s will get a bit less, and here we are, we want to be holy. No, says Peter, it's not a holiness competition. It's holy in order to be missional, in order to be evangelistic. You have to live a holy life. Why? Because you're living as a godly life in a pagan world. The culture in which you are demands holy living. If you live like this, this group, who have no faith, are much more likely to respond positively to the message than if you live an unholy life, then why should they believe it? So this whole book is predicated around mission. It's holiness of life in order that the world might believe. That's very important, because the next bit will make very little sense unless we understand this is about holiness for mission. Remember, Peter's writing to dispersed peoples, mainly from a Jewish background, some of whom were there on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2 and went back to modern-day Turkey, which is roughly the focus of where these people are. So think mission. It's about living in a godly way. So, wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands. We instinctively recoil from that in our pagan world. Submission speaks of brutality and abuse, almost. It's a word in English which doesn't help us. My grandfather, or my mother's father, died many, many years ago. But when I was a little boy, they lived with us at home in a kind of granny annex. I used to go every Saturday afternoon and sit with my grandfather as a little boy, and we used to listen to a commentator called Kent Walton, because wrestling was on television every Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock. This describes my age, okay, right? And my grandfather, gentle soul that he was, when wrestling came on the television, was transformed into this animal who just loved the fact that these guys were brutalizing each other. Actually, it was almost entirely play acting, but he really loved it. And it was a competition of two falls, two submissions, or a knockout. That's how you decided the contest. And the submission element was when you were in so much pain, you gave in, and so you lost. And so submission has kind of taken on this brutality. Wives, almost be brutalized by your husband. It's clearly not what Peter meant. So how are we to understand it? We'll come to that as we go through. So if any of them don't believe the word, now do you see why the missionary theme's important here? This phrase, if any of them do not believe the word. In other words, these are non-believing husbands. And so the behavior patterns I'm now going to tell you are in the context of a missional lifestyle. Again, we'll come back to some of this. So they don't believe the word, these husbands. They got won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see this in your lives. Your beauty, this is a bit controversial here, so I'm going to enjoy this. Your beauty should not come from outward adornments such as braided hair, the wearing of gold jewelry, and fine clothes. Okay, so all you ladies, earrings, necklaces, painted faces, nails. Woo! Is that what it means? Okay, no. Okay, good. So far, so good. So instead, it should be the beauty of your inner self and fading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. Now, what had happened in the ancient world was that during the period at the of Jesus' lifetime, interestingly enough, the Roman Empire had conquered a great deal of the world, and there was a thriving middle class emerging. Thousands of people were slaves, millions were in poverty, but a wealthy middle class was emerging. And so in Rome, for example, this was a period in which wigs were widely worn. Auburn and black were favourites. Makeup from Asia was coming onto the scene. Women, affluent women, wore all sorts of beauty products. It's said that one of the Caesars spent the equivalent of £1 million on a dress for his wife. And so there was luxury and affluence throughout the ancient world because a middle class was being developed. Actually, in one sense, it should have been a good thing. Lydia, the seller of purple in Acts, is an illustration of a woman who made good in business terms. And so there was a growth of economic prosperity brought about, by the way, by the Roman peace. Whenever there's peace, there's prosperity. Ask the people of Syria and Iraq if there's a chance for prosperity. No. Why not? Because there's no peace. Trade becomes very difficult in a war situation, for obvious reasons. And so a middle class is emerging, and there's money to spend, disposable income. And the wealthy spend money on things, makeup and dresses and jewellery and so on. And Peter's saying, that's fine, but that's not what defines you as a wife. If you're trying to win your non-Christian husband to be a follower of Jesus Christ. So this is not, don't wear makeup. Don't wear jewellery, and so on. We'd be condemned. Actually, I'd be condemned too. I'm wearing a piece of jewellery here. So addressed to men and women. So this isn't a negative thing about dressing. It's a negative thing about trusting in that for your status as a human being. Okay. So we'll come back to some of this. Instead, the beauty of it in itself. For this is the way holy women of the past to put their hope in God used to make themselves beautiful. You know, it's about character. They were submissive to their own husbands. There's that word again that frightens us in the West. Like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You see, you are her daughter if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. She called him her master. Some of the versions, the original original NIV, this is a more contemporary one, says, and called him Lord. Okay, now, you know, I've been trying to get Jan to call me Lord, you know, without success for most of our married life, right? Okay, and so who does that? Who calls their husband Lord or Master? I mean, it's pretty rare. Although, interestingly enough, I was with the Bishop of Pakistan and the Gulf some while ago, and his wife was talking to me about how she called him my Lord in public, and I thought it was a really great idea. I came back and shared it with Jan, who didn't have quite the same view. So what does it mean, this? It means about the idea of reverence, and it means the idea of submission in a generic sense, because if this non-Christian husband, who's living in this pagan culture in the first century, where there was a definite hierarchy, male, female, children, slaves, and so on, in a way that contemporary society doesn't have that hierarchy, if you want your husband to come to faith in Christ, the faith you have found, you cannot simply abandon the values of the day and forget they exist. They do exist. And so your pagan husband won't understand it if your newfound faith results in a kind of liberation which is alien to his culture. Now, some really important concepts here. Our culture has changed. When I grew up, Sabbatarianism was very strong in the church and in the culture. My grandparents would never let me play outside on a Sunday at all with any ball or game at all, because the Sabbatarian principle, the Sabbath is sacred, Sunday is the Sabbath. I think they were wrong about that, but their view was this is a special day and we really mustn't do anything. That was mirrored in the culture. Shops were closed on a Sunday, weren't they? I mean, Sunday was, it was a different day. Now our culture shifted. So this morning, and one of the reasons I was a bit late coming to Sea Green was I came out of my house, and in the road outside my house are two grandparents from over that live opposite us with their grandchildren playing with new bikes. Right. Now, my grandparents would have gone over there and tut-tutted and said, you know, it's Sunday, they should take them inside and sit still. So I wandered over there. What do you think I said? I said, "Oh, new bikes. How lovely." You see, now it's hard work for me because, you know, local kids have new bikes. Who cares? But you know, because I'm a guy, you know, whatever. You've got to be nice to young children. You've got to do your best, you know. And I not bother about the grandchildren, but I care about the adults. I want them to think of Christians in a positive way. And so, bearing in mind where the culture is, I wish they were in church this morning, but they're not. So how do I approach that? In a different way than I might have done 50 years ago, were I my grandfather. Because culture's changing. That doesn't mean the word of God changes. It just means the way we approach the culture becomes very different. So here is a culture in which male headship is expressed in significant authority. And by the way, this is still true in vast tracts of the world. Vast tracts of the world. Many men in many nations of the world, one might be argued the majority, believes their wives should be silent, they're not allowed out in public without a male accompaniment, they're not allowed to refuse sexual activity, that they're supposed to be at home and cooking and looking after the kids, and there's no freedom. Don't think that doesn't exist in the world today. It exists in vast tracts of the world today. I'm not saying it's right, I'm just saying it's the reality of the human race. And so in a missional context, if you're going to be a wife who sees a husband one to Christ, don't believe that dressing in fine clothes and wonderful jewelry is going to cut it with him in the gospel terms. Your attitude to him and your quiet spirit, because that's what he's expecting in his culture, that's going to be the thing which leads him to Jesus. So that's the sort of framework there. And that's why most of this is about wives, because in general in the ancient world, and it's not that different today, when people became Christians, women became Christians rather more speedily than men, and there were more male non-Christian partnerships with female Christians, and I guess that would be very true today. So there's only a little bit on husbands. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner. Now, that phrase galls with many people in the women's liberation movement. Just for a moment, be aware that all cultures prior to this point have thought that, and it is a reality that, in general, women are physically weaker than men, in general. Now, I've known some pretty meaty women that would frighten me. It's true. But in general, the physicality of the human frame is clear. Men are stronger than women. I'm not making an emotional point about that, and certainly not a spiritual point. I think that's simply a biological reality. And they're heirs with you see, joint heirs of the gracious gift of life. So the first section is about, if you've got a non-Christian husband in this pagan culture, and you're desperate for them to know the Jesus you know, you've got to live in this particular way. This is not saying that every Christian wife in every culture should behave as a kind of doormat. Now, it's been used, this passage, by Christians in Western culture to misuse it in terms of marriage. Now listen, you know, Jan and I were a couple, we'd been a lot to Seer Green. No one on the planet would accuse my wife of being, you know, a gentle and weak soul. I mean, nobody on the planet would do that. Not unless they'd been drinking heavily or not paying any attention to life, okay? She's not just not that, okay? I have found her a robust companion for many years. Okay, there's an engagement. She's strong-willed. Okay, if you don't understand, I do love it. It's really great. If you don't get that, though, you're in serious trouble. You see, this is not a personality trait. This is not all women should be sweet and quiet and shut up and just generally be dog's bodies around the house the whole time. This is not about that. Thank God, you were saying. Many of you women here are looking incredibly relieved. Because I know some of you ladies, and believe me, you're not like that either. So this is about a missional context. It's not some generic thing for all men and all women at every point to behave in this kind of paternalistic, aggressive, brutalizing, submissive sort of way. So this passage has to be read through the whole of 1 Peter about mission, and the specific illustration of seeing a non-Christian husband being one to Christ. Then the second section. Finally, all of you live in harmony with one another. This is interesting. Peter is roughly got 2.5 chapters to go, and he still says finally. So don't blame just contemporary preachers for pretending they're ending when they're not ending at all. He's got a long way to go yet. So finally is just a bit of a con to keep you reading, because he's not ending yet, let me tell you. So then there's this sort of very practical, live in harmony with one another, don't insult each other, you mustn't do this, that, keep your tongue from evil and so on. Can we have the next screen, please? And then there's this quote that Jan drew attention to. Whoever would love life and see it must do these things. He must turn from evil and do good. And so, do you see, all these practical things are still in a missional context. If you want to be the church of Jesus, and you're a slave, chapter 2, you behave like this. If you're a wife married to a non-Christian husband, behave like this. And if it's all of you, behave like this. Stop gossiping. Don't lie. See, all these practical instructions, live like that. That's practical holiness. Holiness is not some kind of look on your face, or how high you raise your arms in worship, or whether you've got, sort of a beatific kind of smile as you leave church in the morning. I generally, if you walk across the car park and home, should you walk, smiling in some sort of inane, semi-holy way, that's not what will lead people to Jesus, is it? It's a life characterized by these things. And then this incredibly significant phrase, he must seek peace and pursue it. Now notice the echoes of Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mountain. Jesus says, blessed are the peace lovers. Now, what does he actually say? Blessed are the peace makers, those who pursue peace. Not those who... See, this isn't the kind of peace which is the absence of involvement. A bit of trouble going on over there. I'm going to stay out of it and remain peaceful. This is those who actively pursue peace. And this is true at a macro level for the Church of Jesus, as well as a micro level, you and me. See, this past week or so has been among the most turbulent in British politics for a very long time, hasn't it? I mean, are you dead? You've been in the country, haven't you? You've watched the TV from time to time or looked on the internet. I mean, things have gone mad, haven't they? I mean, seriously. I wonder if we all have grasped quite what's happened here. Every single major party at Westminster, every one of them, every major party, almost all the media, print media, with the exception of the Sun, the BBC, all the media, was in favour of remaining. And the country voted not to. Since then, we've been treated to a very immature political system and a grotesque, hysterical media. Now, I have to tell you that hysteria is not a Christian response. It's not a Christian response. It's not a godly response, not a biblical response. Hysteria is never God's response. The response is to seek peace and to pursue it. You see, the idea, and both sides are guilty of this, the idea that, you know, the weather's going to get worse if we vote to leave, because we won't be attached to Europe anymore, so we won't get as much of their sun. You know, it's just bonkers. As was much of the stuff on either side of the campaign. It's a great story about $350 million for the national health, and then someone said, oh yeah, of course we were lying about that. Oh, that's all right then. That's good. I'm really glad now we knew you were lying. Well, could you have mentioned that earlier? See, the whole thing is just crazy. But what's our job now in the midst of this hysterical speech? The media are so guilty. We promised you a recession, and by gum, we're going to talk until we get one. That's what the media are doing. Eisenhower once said, you've got nothing to fear but fear itself. God, we're talking ourselves into this great state of panic. It would be funny were it not so sad. What's our job in all of that, whether you voted to remain or to leave? It is, as the praise that Alison so helpfully repeated in her prayer and Jan mentioned, it is to seek peace and to pursue it. We are where we are now. How can we seek peace as a church? I mean, not just mean Seer Green Baptist Church, I mean the Church of Jesus in the nation. To be saying to people, our job is to seek peace and goodwill and to pursue it. And peace is not an absence of justice. You're not abandoning truth so everybody's just happy together. It's a much more profound thing to seek peace and to pursue it. And so all of this has national implications as well as personal implications. Do not fear what non-Christians fear. Don't be frightened. In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Jesus has to be the center. That'll be my final point in just a minute. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope you have. Do you see why this is so missional? Look, here you are. What do Christians believe then? What do Christians think about this? How am I supposed to behave? What do Christians... and so on. Have an answer. Prepare. Think about what a Christian response might be. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience. In other words, not arrogantly. This whole debate actually nationally has been characterized by a kind of arrogance. If you don't agree with me, you're stupid. That's the tone. Well, how sad is that? So be gentle in the way you do it. And people will be ashamed of their slander and behavior if only you just keep focused on Christ. Then the next bit. And so then you get to the section which is really incomprehensible. This is the bit that scholars have struggled with for 2,000 years and argued about. And it's this section here. He was put to death in the body, that's Jesus, well, we understand that, and made alive by the Spirit, we understand that. That's the death of Jesus on the cross and the resurrection. So far, so straightforward. Through whom also he went and preached to the spirits in prison. Who on earth are they? These spirits in prison, are they in a literal prison in Turkey? In which case, how did Jesus go and speak to them? What does it mean? Oh no, wait a minute, the next sentence. You know what happens in the Bible study? I'll just pause for a moment. In Bible study, if you read a sentence and you don't understand it, this is my advice. Read the next sentence. Because sometimes the next sentence makes things better. And then the next sentence makes things a bit better. And if you read back a chapter or two, it makes it even better. Because context is everything. Now here, in a minute, when you read the next sentence, it makes things worse. I'm just telling you that. It gets worse before it gets better. Here, in understanding this. Here it is. Where are we? Who are these saints in prison? The ones who disobeyed long ago when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. So these are people who are somewhere called prison, and they're from the time of Noah, presumably 8 saved in a boat and the rest died. Jesus somehow preached to them. In it, only a few people were saved through water, obviously the flood, and this water was symbolic of baptism, and obviously baptism symbolizes washing and the regeneration that God brings. Not the removal of dirt from your body, in other words, you don't just get clean, but with the good conscience towards God. In other words, spiritual cleanliness. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. Amen. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Well, sometimes at home... my dad would talk to us as children about difficult things, in the Bible. And we'd ask him lots of questions about things. And sometimes, particularly when I was a teenager, I was fairly persistent in my questioning of my father. And he would say, my mother's name's Sylvia, and he would say, Syl, when the debate got a bit heated and we needed a bit more time, he'd say, Syl, go and put the kettle on. Which meant, this is going to take some time. Right. And I'm tempted to say to you, who's on refreshments? Go with the kettle on. Bring them all in. It's going to take ages to sort this out. But I'm actually going to deal with it in the next 2 or 3 minutes. You'll be pleased to know. Then you can muse on it later before we get back to the key practical 1 or 2 points in all of this. So, what's going on here? Well, the short answer is that theologians and Bible scholars, far more gifted, erudite, and intelligent than me, have been arguing about this for 2,000 years. Not arguing in a bad way, but just not really knowing what Peter's trying to say. And I can tell you with absolute confidence that I don't know for sure either. And I think it's just important at times for preachers not to pretend they know the answer when they don't. So, I think what is going on here, and I can't be sure, is that part of the whole Jewish mythology of the past, wrapped up with stories about an afterlife and Sheol and a netherworld and all this sort of stuff, was about people having in some sort of waiting room, waiting for Messiah to come, after life, I mean. And when Messiah would come, and of course the Jews didn't believe it was Jesus, but when Messiah would come, all those people would somehow have this chance to hear about the message of Messiah, and then a chance to respond to be get out of the waiting room into the proper heaven somewhere else. And there does seem to be some sort of Jewish mythology around that sort of concept. Not that the Bible teaches that, the Bible doesn't teach that, but some sort of Jewish mythology. And it seems to me that what Peter might be doing is saying, look, because mainly he's writing to a Jewish audience, you guys will have heard these things, right? And you'll be wondering what happens to people who've died long before Jesus came. Well, I am telling you, using a fairly graphic metaphor, that whoever is dead before Jesus came, whatever their state, Jesus has dealt with it, and he's reliable and trustworthy. And even though there are questions you don't know the answer to, and I don't know the answer to, and it's all pretty mysterious, and it's weird, and who knows what went on in those lives of Old Testament saints before Jesus came, I'm telling you, Jesus has got it under control. He's sorted it out. He's been there. He's done it. If there is such a place, Jesus has sorted it out. Not that Peter's saying there is such a place, but that Jesus has sorted it out. And what the key thing here is, that if the resurrection of Jesus is true, and he's gone into heaven, and he's at God's right hand, and all these powers are in submission to Jesus. Have you noticed that this is the end of the chapter, uses the same word the beginning of the chapter uses, submission. In the first bit of the chapter, submission of husbands and wives, the end of the chapter, all the powers being in submission to Jesus. And so it's very unclear what Peter's getting at here. And I don't think there is massive clarity anywhere in the world, except to say that Peter is utterly, utterly clear that Jesus is the victor over all the powers. And so in this pagan culture in which we're supposed to be witnesses, says Peter, there are all sorts of complexities. Slave-master, that's a complex relationship because the seeds of decay are sown in the New Testament. Ultimately, Christians, having read their Bibles, all the way through to William Wilberforce and others, saw slavery abolished because of what they believed the Bible taught about the worth of a human being. But Peter doesn't say abolish slavery. He says, in the world in which slavery is a reality, this is how you should behave if you want the kingdom to come. In a world in which male headship is guaranteed, is often brutal and cruel, if you want your husband to come to know Jesus, this is how you're going to have to behave in this cultural context. And if you want everybody else to come to know Jesus in a pagan world where they don't respect Jesus and they worship lots of gods, you better do what the central section says, which is you better stop lying and tell the truth and always be ready to give an answer and all these practical things. And by the way, when everything is in turmoil, seek peace and pursue it. And by the way, as an addendum, don't you worry about the big questions about what happens to people in this state or that or the time of Noah or whenever. Jesus is alive from the dead, and he's got all the answers even though we don't. And all the powers and all the questions find their answer in him. That's what faith's about. I don't know what the answer is, but we trust the one who's risen from the dead. So really, that's 1 Peter 3 in a nutshell. And next time you invite me, give me an easy passage to come and speak to. Then I'd be glad to come and talk about that. So in this missionary context in which we all find ourselves, those are our values and principles. And you'll notice that the name of Jesus becomes more and more and more central to the chapter as the chapter goes on. And so Peter is giving practical advice, and then he starts to say, because this is what Jesus would do, and this is what happened to Jesus, and Jesus was risen, and he died in the body, and then he was made alive by the Spirit, and then he's resurrected, and then all the powers are subject to him. And so in the end, you see, I don't know the answer to every question. I don't know the answer to many questions. But I do know that Jesus knows the answer. And I do know that what our world needs in this tumultuous scene at the moment is it needs more of Jesus, not more religion, not more church, not more religious observance, but an encounter with the one who was dead and is now alive. That's what the world needs. Jesus at the center of its whole existence. Because when Jesus is at the center of marriage, truly at the center, I'm talking about Western marriage now, the questions related to headship and submission and so on fall away in the focus on Jesus. You see, we have a relatively old-fashioned marriage, Jan and I. Jan is entirely the queen of the domestic arena. I am entirely excluded from the domestic arena. And I have to say, by choice. I'm not suggesting for one minute that is a paradigm for Christian marriage. That's not the only way to do it. We believe that I'm the head of our marriage. You can ask her afterwards. I'm not putting words in her mouth. Ask her. I won't check up. It's the way we understand it. But if you ask us, how many times in 35 years of marriage have I stood in our living room and said, I'm the head of this marriage, and we're going to do this? How many times has that happened in 35 years? None. Because the issue is not to do with that, ultimately, however we configure our marriage. It's to do with if Jesus is at the center, much of that falls into place. And that's where Jesus has to be at the center of marriage. And Jesus has to be at the center of our daily lives. Because whether I voted Remain or Leave, or I'm Conservative or Labour or Liberal or anything else for that matter, you can't serve two masters. So in the end, is Jesus the Lord or not? In the end, that's the big question for us. Jesus at the center of our lives. And then what about all these unanswered questions? What's going to happen about this or this or this in our culture? And where's it all going? And all those theological questions about what about people who've never heard the gospel? And you know, those big questions we have all the time. In the end, you say, it's all about Jesus. He knows. That sounds a bit of a cop-out. But in the end, there are some questions that won't be answered satisfactorily this side of eternity. But Jesus knows. And we can trust him. So I don't know what's going to happen in our country over the next few years. Folks, I don't know what's going to happen over the next few minutes. I've left my phone on, actually, in case I'm invited to join the shadow cabinet. I mean, I could easily be called up any moment. The pace of change is breathtaking. But I know Jesus knows. And I know he's in charge. And I trust him. And our lives, really, are about trusting this Jesus in a pagan culture that's gone mad in some ways. Hysterical. And into that, we seek peace and pursue it. We love one another, and we love Jesus. And that demonstrates true holiness when we do that. May God bless you.